outside. Do you need an introduction? Lysandra's smile grew.
I like your fangs, she said sweetly.
Aelin choked on her grape. Of course Lysandra did. Rowan gave a little grin that usually sent Aelin running.
Are you studying them so you can replicate them when you take my form, shapeshifter?
Aelin's fork froze in midair.
Bullshit,
Adian said. All amusement had vanished from the courtesan's face.
Shapeshifter. Holy gods.
What was fire magic or wind and ice compared to shapeshifting? Shifters. Spies and thieves and assassins able to demand any price for their services. The bane of courts across the world. So feared that they'd been hunted nearly to extinction even before Otterlin had banned magic. Lysandra plucked up a grape, examined it, and then flicked her eyes to Rowan.
Perhaps I'm just studying you to know where to sink my fangs if I ever get my gifts back.
Rowan laughed. It explained so much.
You and I are nothing but beasts wearing human skins.
Lysandra turned her attention to Aelin.
No one knows this. Not even Arabin.
Her face was hard. A challenge and a question lay in those eyes.
Secrets.
Nehemia had kept secrets from her, too. Aelin didn't say anything. Lysandra's mouth tightened as she turned to Rowan.
How do you know?
A shrug. Even as Aelin felt his attention on her and knew he could read the emotions biting at her.
I met a few shifters, centuries ago. Your scents are the same.
Lysandra sniffed at herself, but Adian murmured,
So that's what it is.
Lysandra looked at Aelin again.
Say something.
Aelin held up a hand.
Just give me a moment.
A moment to sort out one friend from another. The friend she had loved and who had lied to her at every chance. And the friend she had hated and who she had kept secrets from herself. Hated until love and hate had met in the middle, fused by loss. Adian asked,
How old were you when you found out?
Young. 5 or 6. I knew even then to hide it from everyone. It wasn't my mother, so my father must have had the gift. She never mentioned him. Or seemed to miss him.
Gift. Interesting choice of words. Rowan said,
What happened to her?
Lysandra shrugged.
I don't know. I was 7 when she beat me, then threw me out of the house. Because we lived here, in this city. And that morning, for the first time, I'd made the mistake of shifting in her presence. I don't remember why, but I remember being startled enough that I changed into a hissing tabby right in front of her.
Shit, Adian said. So you're a full-powered shifter,
Rowan said.
I'd known what I was for a long time. From even before that moment, I knew that I could change into any creature. But magic was outlawed here. And everyone, in every kingdom, was distrustful of shapeshifters. How could they not be?
A low laugh.
After she kicked me out, I was left on the streets. We were poor enough that it was hardly different, but I spent the first 2 days crying on the doorstep. She threatened to turn me into the authorities, so I ran. And I never saw her again. I even went back to the house months later, but she was gone. Moved away.
She sounds like a wonderful person, Adian said.
Lysandra hadn't lied to her. Nehemia had lied outright, kept things that were vital. What Lysandra was, they were even. After all, she hadn't told Lysandra she was queen.
How'd you survive?
Aelin asked at last, her shoulders relaxing. A 7-year-old on the streets of Rifthold doesn't often meet a happy end.
Something sparked in Lysandra's eyes.
And Aelin wondered if she had been waiting for the blow to fall, waiting for the order to get out.
I used my abilities. Sometimes I was human, sometimes I wore the skins of other street children, with high standing in their packs. Sometimes I became an alley cat or a rat or a gull. And then I learned that if I made myself prettier, if I made myself beautiful, when I begged for money it came far faster. I was wearing one of those beautiful faces the day magic fell, and I've been stuck in it ever since.
So, this face, Aelin said, isn't your real face? Your real body?
No. And what kills me is that I can't remember what my real face was. That's the danger of shifting. That you would forget your real form, because it's the memory of it that guides the shifting. I remember being plain as a dormouse, but I don't remember if my eyes were blue or gray or green. I can't remember the shape of my nose or my chin. And it was a child's body, too. I don't know what I would look like now, as a woman.
Aelin said, and this was the form that Aerobin spotted you in a few years later. Lysandra nodded and picked at an invisible fleck of lint on her dress.
If magic is free again, would you be wary of a shapeshifter?
So carefully phrased, so casually asked, as if it weren't the most important question of all. Aelin shrugged and gave her the truth. I'd be jealous of a shapeshifter. Shifting into any form I please would come in rather handy, she considered it.
A shapeshifter would make a powerful ally,
and an even more entertaining friend. Adian mused. It would make a difference on a battlefield once magic is freed. Rowan just asked, did you have a favorite form? Lysandra's grin was nothing short of wicked.
I liked anything with claws and big, big fangs.
Aelin swallowed her laugh. Is there a reason behind this visit, Lysandra, or are you just here to make my friends squirm? All amusement faded, as Lysandra held up a velvet sack that sagged with what looked to be a large box.
What you requested.
The box thumped as she set the sack onto the worn wooden table. Aelin slid the sack toward herself, even as the males raised their brows and subtly sniffed at the box within.
Thank you.
Lysandra said,
Aerobin is going to call in your favor tomorrow, to be delivered the following night. Be ready.
Good. It was an effort to keep her face blank. Adian leaned forward, glancing between them. Does he expect only Aelin to deliver it?
No. All of you, I think.
Rowan said, is it a trap?
Probably, in some way or another, Lysandra said. He wants you to deliver it, and then join him for dinner.
Demons and dining, Aelin said.
A delightful combination.
Only Lysandra smiled. Will he poison us? Adian asked. Aelin scratched at a piece of dirt on the table. Poison is an Aerobin style. If he were to do anything to the food, it would be to add some drug that would incapacitate us while he had us moved wherever he wanted. It's the control that he loves, she added, still staring at the table, not quite feeling like seeing what was written on Rowan or Adian's face. The pain and fear, yes, but the power is what he really thrives on. Lysandra's face had lost its softness, her eyes cold and sharp, a reflection of Aelin's own, no doubt. The only person who could understand, who had also learned firsthand exactly how far that lust for control went. Aelin rose from her seat. I'll walk you to your carriage. She and Lysandra paused among the stacks of crates in the warehouse.
Are you ready?
Lysandra asked, crossing her arms. Aelin nodded. I'm not sure the debt could ever be paid for what they all did, but it will have to be enough. I'm running out of time. Lysandra pursed her lips.
I won't be able to risk coming here again until afterward.
Thank you.
For everything. He could still have a few tricks up his sleeve. Be on your guard.
And you be on yours.
You're not mad that I didn't tell you.
Your secret could get you killed just as easily as mine, Lysandra. I just felt, I don't know. If anything, I wondered if I'd done something wrong. Something to make you not trust me enough to tell me.
I've wanted to. I've been dying to.
Aelin believed her. You risked those Vol guards for me. For Adian, that day we rescued him, Aelin said. They'd probably be beside themselves if they learned there was a shifter in this city. And that night at the pits, when she'd kept turning away from the Vol and hiding behind Aerobin, it had been to avoid their notice.
You have to be insane. Even before I knew who you were, Aelin, I knew that what you were working toward, it was worth it.
What is? Her throat tightened.
A world where people like me don't have to hide.
Lysandra turned away. But Aelin grabbed her by the hand. Lysandra smiled a bit.
Times like these, I wish I had your particular skill set instead.
Would you do it if you could? About 2 nights from now, I mean. Lysandra gently let go of her hand.
I've thought about it every single day since Wesley died. I would do it. And gladly. But I don't mind if you do it. You won't hesitate. I find that comforting somehow.
The invitation arrived by street urchin at 10 o'clock the next morning. Aelin stared at the cream-colored envelope on the table before the fireplace. Its red wax seal imprinted with crossed daggers. Adian and Rowan, peering over her shoulders, studied the box it had come with. Both males sniffed and frowned.
It smells like almonds, Adian said.
She pulled out the card, a formal invitation for dinner tomorrow at 8, for her and 2 guests, and a request for the favor owed to him. His patience was at an end, but in typical Aerobin fashion, dumping the demon at his doorstep wouldn't be enough. No, she'd deliver it on his terms. The dinner was late enough in the day to give her time to stew. There was a note at the end of the invitation, in an elegant yet efficient scrawl.
A gift, and one I hope you'll wear tomorrow night.
She chucked the card onto the table and waved a hand to Adian or Rowan to open the box as she walked to the window and looked out toward the castle. It was blindingly bright in the morning sun, glimmering as though it had been crafted from pearl and gold and silver. The slither of ribbon, the thought of the box lid opening, and,
"What the hell is that?"
She glanced over her shoulder. Adian held a large glass bottle in his hands, full of amber liquid. She said flatly,
"Perfumed skin oil."
"Why does he want you to wear it?"
Adian asked too quietly. She looked out the window again. Rowan stalked over and perched on the armchair behind her, a steady force at her back. Aelin said,
"It's just another move in the game we've been playing."
She'd have to rub it into her skin, his scent. She told herself that she'd expected nothing less, but...
"And you're going to use it?"
Adian spat.
"Tomorrow, our one goal is to get the amulet of Orinth from him. Agreeing to wear that oil will put him on unsure footing."
"I don't follow."
"The invitation is a threat,"
Rowan replied for her. She could feel him inches away, was aware of his movements as much as her own.
"2 companions. He knows how many of us are here, knows who you are."
"And you?"
Adian asked. The fabric of his shirt sighed against Rowan's skin as he shrugged.
"He's probably figured out by now that I'm Fae."
The thought of Rowan facing Aerobin, and what Aerobin might try to do.
"And what about the demon?" Adian demanded. "He expects us to bring it over in all our finery?"
"Another test, and yes."
"So, when do we go catch ourselves a Vogue, Commander?"
Aelin and Rowan glanced at each other.
"You're staying here," she said to Adian.
"Like hell I am."
She pointed to his side. "If you hadn't been a hot-headed pain in my ass and torn your stitches when you sparred with Rowan, you could have come.
But you're still on the mend, and I'm not going to risk exposing your wounds to the filth in the sewers just so you can feel better about yourself."
Adian's nostrils flared as he reined in his temper.
"You're going to face a demon."
"She'll be taken care of,"
Rowan said.
"I can take care of myself," she snapped. "I'm going to get dressed."
She grabbed her suit from where she'd left it drying over an armchair before the open windows. Adian sighed behind her.
"Please, just be safe. And Lysandra is to be trusted?"
"We'll find out tomorrow," she said.
She trusted Lysandra. She wouldn't have let her near Adian otherwise. But Lysandra wouldn't necessarily know if Aerobin was using her. Rowan lifted his brows.
"Are you all right?"
She nodded.
"I just want to get through these 2 days and be done with it."
"That will never stop being strange," Adian muttered.
"Deal with it," she told him, carrying the suit into the bedroom.
Let's go hunt ourselves a pretty little demon. Chapter 39.
Dead as dead can be, Aelin said, towing the upper half of the wordhound's remains. Rowan, crouching over one of the bottom bits, growled his confirmation.
Lorcan doesn't pull punches, does he? She said, studying the reeking, blood-splattered sewer crossroads.
There was hardly anything left of the Volg captains, or the wordhound. In a matter of moments, Lorcan had massacred them all as if they were chattel.
Gods above.
Lorcan probably spent the entire fight imagining each of these creatures was you,
Rowan said, rising from his crouch bearing a clawed arm.
The stone skin seems like armor, but inside it's just flesh.
He sniffed at it and snarled in disgust.
Good. And thank you, Lorcan, for finding that out for us.
She strode to Rowan, taking the heavy arm from him, and waved at the prince with the creature's stiff fingers.
Stop that, he hissed.
She wriggled the demon's fingers a bit more. It'd make a good back scratcher. Rowan only frowned.
Killjoy, she said,
and chucked the arm onto the torso of the wordhound. It landed with a heavy thump and click of stone.
So, Lorcan can bring down a wordhound.
Rowan snorted at the name she'd coined.
And once it's down, it seems like it stays down.
Good to know. Rowan eyed her warily.
This trap wasn't just to send Lorcan a message, was it?
These things are the king's puppets, she said. So his grand imperial majesty now has a read on Lorcan's face and smell. And I suspect he will not be very pleased to have a fey warrior in his city. Why, I bet that Lorcan is currently being pursued by the 7 other wordhounds, who no doubt have a score to settle on behalf of their king and their fallen brother.
Rowan shook his head.
I don't know whether to throttle you or clap you on the back.
I think there's a long line of people who feel the same way.
She scanned the sewer-turned charnel house.
I needed Lorcan's eyes elsewhere tonight and tomorrow.
And I needed to know whether these wordhounds could be killed.
Why?
He saw too much.
Slowly, she met his gaze.
Because I'm going to use their beloved sewer entrance to get into the castle, and blow up the clock tower right from under them.
Rowan let out a low, wicked chuckle.
That's how you're going to free magic.
Once Lorcan kills the last of the wordhounds, you're going in.
He really should have killed me, considering the world of trouble that's now hunting him through this city.
Rowan bared his teeth in a feral smile.
He had it coming.
Cloaked, armed, and masked, Aelin leaned against the stone wall of the abandoned building, while Rowan circled the bound Volg commander in the center of the room.
You've signed your death warrant, you maggots,
the thing inside the guard's body said. Aelin clicked her tongue.
You must not be a very good demon to be captured so easily.
It had been a joke, really. Aelin had picked the smallest patrol led by the mildest of the commanders. She and Rowan had ambushed the patrol just before midnight in a quiet part of the city. She'd barely killed 2 guards before the rest were dead at Rowan's hand. And when the commander tried to run, the Fey warrior had caught him within heartbeats. Rendering him unconscious had been the work of a moment. The hardest part had been dragging his carcass across the slums, into the building and down into the cellar, where they'd chained him to a chair.
I'm not a demon,
the man hissed, as if every word burned him. Aelin crossed her arms. Rowan, bearing both Goldrin and Damaris, circled the man, a hawk closing in on prey.
Then what's the ring for? She said.
A gasp of breath. Human. Labored.
To enslave us. Corrupt us.
And?
Come closer, and I might tell you.
His voice changed then, deeper and colder.
What's your name?
Rowan asked.
Your human tongues cannot pronounce our names. Or our language,
the demon said.
She mimicked. Your human tongues cannot pronounce our names.
I've heard that one before, unfortunately. Aelin let out a low laugh as the creature inside the man seethed. What is your name? Your real name? The man thrashed, a violent jerking motion that made Rowan step closer. She carefully monitored the battle between the two beings inside that body. At last, it said,
"Stevan!"
"Stevan," she said. The man's eyes were clear, fixed on her. "Stevan," she said again, louder.
"Quiet,"
the demon snapped. "Where are you from, Stevan?"
"Enough of..."
"Melisande!"
"Stevan," she repeated. It hadn't worked on the day of Adian's escape. It hadn't been enough then, but now. "Do you have a family, Stevan?"
"Dead. All of them."
"Just as you will be."
He stiffened, slumped, stiffened, slumped. "Can you take off the ring?"
"Never,"
the thing said. "Can you come back, Stevan, if the ring is gone?" A shudder that left his head hanging between his shoulders.
"I don't want to, even if I could."
"Why?"
"The things. Things I did. We did."
He liked to watch while I took them. While I ripped them apart.
Rowan stopped his circling, standing beside her. Despite his mask, she could almost see the look on his face. The disgust and pity. "Tell me about the Volg princes," Aelin said. Both man and demon were silent. "Tell me about the Volg princes," she ordered.
"They are darkness. They are glory. They are eternal."
"Stevan, tell me. Is there one here, in Rifthold?"
"Yes."
"Whose body is it inhabiting?"
"The Crown Prince's."
"Is the prince in there, as you are in there?"
"I never saw him. Never spoke to him. If it's a prince inside him, I can't hold out, can't stand this thing. If it's a prince..."
"The prince will have broken him, used and taken him."
"Dorian. Dorian." The man breathed.
"Please."
His voice so empty and soft compared to that of the thing inside him.
"Please, just end it. I can't hold it."
"Liar,"
she purred. "You gave yourself to it."
"No choice,"
the man gasped out.
"They came to our homes, our families. They said the rings were part of the uniform, so we had to wear them."
A shudder went through him, and something ancient and cold smiled at her.
"What are you, woman?"
It licked its lips.
"Let me taste you. Tell me what you are."
Aelin studied the black ring on its finger. Cain. Once upon a time, months and lifetimes ago, Cain had fought the thing inside him. There had been a day, in the halls of the castle, when he'd looked hounded, hunted, as if despite the ring. "I am death," she said simply, "should you want it." The man sagged. The demon vanishing.
"Yes,"
he sighed.
"Yes."
"What would you offer me in exchange?"
"Anything,"
the man breathed.
"Please."
She looked at his hand, at his ring, and reached into her pocket, then listened carefully. Aelin awoke, drenched in sweat and twisted in the sheets, fear clenching her like a fist. She willed herself to breathe, to blink, to look at the moon-bathed room, to turn her head and see the Fey Prince slumbering across the bed. Alive, not tortured, not dead. Still, she reached a hand out over the sea of blankets between them and touched his bare shoulder. Rock-hard muscle encased in velvet-soft skin. Real. They'd done what they needed to, and the Volg commander was locked in another building, ready and waiting for tomorrow night, when they would bring him to the keep. Aerobin's favor at last fulfilled. But the words of the demon rang through her head, and then they blended with the voice of the Volg prince that had used Dorian's mouth like a puppet.
"I will destroy everything that you love."
"A promise."
Aelin loosed a breath, careful not to disturb the Fey prince sleeping beside her. For a moment, it was hard to pull back the hand touching his arm. For a moment, she was tempted to stroke her fingers down the curve of muscle. But she had one last thing to do tonight.
so she withdrew her hand. And this time, he didn't wake when she crept out of the room. It was almost 4 in the morning when she slipped back into the bedroom, her boots clutched in one hand. She made it all of 2 steps, 2 immensely heavy, exhausted steps, before Rowan said from the bed,
"You smell like ash."
She just kept going until she dropped her boots off in the closet, stripped down into the first shirt she could find, and washed her face and neck.
"I had things to do,"
she said as she climbed into bed.
"You were stealthier this time."
The rage simmering off him was almost hot enough to burn through the blankets.
"This wasn't particularly high risk."
Lie. Lie, lie, lie.
She'd just been lucky.
"And I suppose you're not going to tell me until you want to?"
She slumped against the pillows.
"Don't get pissy because I out-stealthed you."
His snarl reverberated across the mattress.
"It's not a joke."
She closed her eyes, her limbs leaden.
"I know."
"Aelin."
She was already asleep. Rowan wasn't pissy. No, pissy didn't cover a fraction of it. The rage was still riding him the next morning, when he awoke before she did and slipped into her closet to examine the clothes she'd shucked off. Dust and metal and smoke and sweat tickled his nose. And there were streaks of dirt and ash on the black cloth. Only a few daggers lay scattered nearby. No sign of Goldrin or Damaris having been moved from where he'd dumped them on the closet floor last night. No whiff of Lorkin or the Volg. No scent of blood. Either she hadn't wanted to risk losing the ancient blades in a fight, or she hadn't wanted the extra weight. She was sprawled across the bed when he emerged, his jaw clenched. She hadn't even bothered to wear one of those ridiculous nightgowns. She must have been exhausted enough not to bother with anything other than that oversized shirt. His shirt, he noticed with no small amount of male satisfaction. It was enormous on her. It was so easy to forget how much smaller she was than him. How mortal. And how utterly unaware of the control he had to exercise every day, every hour, to keep her at arm's length, to keep from touching her. He glowered at her before striding out of the bedroom. In the mountains, he would have made her go on a run, or chop wood for hours, or pull extra kitchen duty. This apartment was too small. Too full of males used to getting their own way, and a queen used to getting hers. Worse, a queen hell-bent on keeping secrets. He'd dealt with young rulers before. Maeve had dispatched him to enough foreign courts that he knew how to get them to heal. But Aelin... she'd taken him out to hunt demons. And yet this task, whatever she had done, required even him to be kept in ignorance. Rowan filled the kettle, focusing on each movement, if only to keep from throwing it through the window.
"Making breakfast? How domestic of you."
Aelin leaned against the doorway, irreverent as always.
"Shouldn't you be sleeping like the dead, considering your busy night?"
"Can we not get into a fight about it before my first cup of tea?"
With lethal calm, he set the kettle on the stove.
"After tea, then?"
She crossed her arms, sunlight kissing the shoulder of her pale blue robe. Such a creature of luxury, his queen. And yet, she hadn't bought a single new thing for herself lately. She loosed a breath, and her shoulders slumped a bit. The rage roaring through his veins stumbled, and stumbled again when she chewed on her lip.
"I need you to come with me today."
"Anywhere you need to go,"
he said. She looked toward the table, at the stove.
"To Aerobin?"
He hadn't forgotten for 1 second where they would be going tonight. What she would be facing. She shook her head, then shrugged.
"No, I mean, yes, I want you to come tonight, but there's something else I need to do, and I want to do today, before everything happens."
He waited, restraining himself from going to her, from asking her to tell him more. That had been their promise to each other. Space to sort out their own miserable lives, to sort out how to share them. He didn't mind, most of the time. She rubbed at her brows with her thumb and forefinger. and when she squared her shoulders, those silk-clad shoulders that bore a weight he'd do anything to relieve, she lifted her chin.
There's a grave I need to visit.
She didn't have a black gown fit for mourning, but Aelin figured Sam would have preferred to see her in something bright and lovely anyway. So she wore a tunic the color of spring grass, its sleeves capped with dusty golden velvet cuffs. Life, she thought, as she strode through the small, pretty graveyard overlooking the aviary. The clothes Sam would have wanted her to wear reminded her of life. The graveyard was empty, but the headstones and grass were well kept, and the towering oaks were budding with new leaves. A breeze coming in off the glimmering river set them sighing and ruffled her unbound hair, which was back now to its normal honey gold. Rowan had stayed near the little iron gate, leaning against one of those oaks to keep passers-by on the quiet city street behind them from noticing him. If they did, his black clothes and weapons painted him as a mere bodyguard. She had planned to come alone, but this morning she'd awoken and just needed him with her. The new grass cushioned each step between the pale headstones, bathed in the sunlight streaming down. She picked up pebbles along the way, discarding the misshapen and rough ones, keeping those that gleamed with bits of quartz or color. She clutched a fistful of them by the time she approached the last line of graves at the edge of the large, muddy river flowing lazily past. It was a lovely grave, simple, clean, and on the stone was written, Sam Cortland, Beloved. Aerobin had left it blank, unmarked, but Wesley had explained in his letter how he'd asked the tombstone carver to come. She approached the grave, reading it over and over. Beloved, not just by her, but by many. Sam, her Sam. For a moment, she stared at that stretch of grass, at the white stone. For a moment, she could see that beautiful face grinning at her, yelling at her, loving her. She opened her fist of pebbles and picked out the three loveliest, two for the years since he'd been taken from her. One for what they'd been together. Carefully, she placed them at the apex of the headstone's curve. Then she sat down against the stone, tucking her feet beneath her, and rested her head against the smooth, cool rock.
Hello, Sam,
she breathed onto the river breeze. She said nothing for a time, content to be near him, even in this form. The sun warmed her hair, a kiss of heat along her scalp. A trace of Mala, perhaps, even here. She began talking, quietly and succinctly, telling Sam about what had happened to her 10 years ago, telling him about these past 9 months. When she was done, she stared up at the oak leaves rustling overhead and dragged her fingers through the soft grass.
I miss you, she said.
Every day I miss you, and I wonder what you would have made of all this, made of me.
I think you would have been a wonderful king.
I think they would have liked you more than me, actually. Her throat tightened.
I never told you how I felt,
but I loved you, and I think a part of me might always love you.
Maybe you were my mate, and I never knew it. Maybe I'll spend the rest of my life wondering about that.
Maybe I'll see you again in the afterworld, and then I'll know for sure.
But until then I'll miss you, and I'll wish you were here.
She would not apologize, nor say it was her fault, because his death wasn't her fault. And tonight she would settle that debt. She wiped at her face with the back of her sleeve and got to her feet. The sun dried her tears. She smelled the pine and snow before she heard him. And when she turned, Rowan stood a few feet away, staring at the headstone behind her.
I know who he was to you.
Rowan said softly, and held out his hand, not to take hers, but for a stone. She opened her fist, and he sorted through the pebbles until he found one, smooth and round, the size of a hummingbird's egg. With a gentleness that cracked her heart, he set it on the headstone beside her own pebbles.
You're going to kill Aerobin tonight, aren't you?
He said. After the dinner, when he's gone to bed, I'm going back to the keep and ending it. She'd come here to remind herself,
remind herself why that grave before them existed, and why she had those scars on her back.
And the amulet of Orinth?
An endgame, but also a distraction. The sunlight danced on the aviary, nearly blinding.
You're ready to do it?
She looked back at the gravestone, and at the grass concealing the coffin beneath. I have no choice but to be ready. Chapter 40 Elide spent 2 days on voluntary kitchen duty, learning where and when the laundresses ate and who brought their food. By that point, the head cook trusted her enough that when she volunteered to bring the bread up to the dining hall, he didn't think twice. No one noticed when she sprinkled the poison onto a few rolls of bread. The wingleader had sworn it wouldn't kill, just make the laundress sick for a few days. And maybe it made her selfish for placing her own survival first. But Elide didn't hesitate as she dumped the pale powder onto some of the rolls, blending it into the flour that dusted them. Elide marked one roll in particular to make sure she gave it to the laundress she'd noted days before, but the others would be given out at random to the other laundresses.
Hell, she was likely going to burn in Hellas's realm forever for this.
But she could think about her damnation when she had escaped and was far, far away, beyond the southern continent. Elide limped into the raucous dining hall, a quiet cripple with yet another platter of food. She made her way down the long table, trying to keep the weight off her leg as she leaned in again and again to deposit rolls onto plates. The laundress didn't even bother to thank her. The next day, the keep was abuzz with the news that a third of the laundresses were sick. It must have been the chicken at dinner, they said, or the mutton, or the soup, since only some of them had had it. The cook apologized, and Elide had tried not to apologize to him when she saw the terror in his eyes. The head laundress actually looked relieved when Elide limped in and volunteered to help. She told her to pick any station and get to work. Perfect. But guilt pushed down on her shoulders as she went right to that woman's station. She worked all day and waited for the bloodied clothes to arrive. When they finally did, there was not as much blood as before, but more of a substance that looked like vomit. Elide almost vomited herself as she washed them all, and wrung them out, and dried them, and pressed them. It took hours. Night was falling when she folded the last of them, trying to keep her fingers from shaking. But she went up to the head laundress and said softly, no more than a nervous girl,
Should I bring them back?
The woman smirked. Elide wondered if the other laundress had been sent down there as a punishment. There's a stairwell over that way that will take you to the subterranean levels. Tell the guards you're Misty's replacement. Bring the clothes to the second door on the left and drop them outside. The woman looked at Elide's chains. Try to run out if you can. Elide's bowels had turned to water by the time she reached the guards. But they didn't so much as question her as she recited what the head laundress had said. Down, down, down she walked, into the gloom of the spiral stairwell. The temperature plummeted the farther she descended. And then she heard the moaning. Moans of pain, of terror, of despair. She held the basket of clothes to her chest. A torch flickered ahead.
Gods, it was so cold here.
The stairs widened toward the bottom, flaring out into a straight descent and revealing a broad hallway, lit with torches and lined with countless iron doors. The moans were coming from behind them. Second door on the left. It was gouged with what looked like claw marks, pushing out from within. There were guards down here. Guards and strange men, patrolling up and down, opening and closing the doors. Elide's knees wobbled. No one stopped her. She set the basket of laundry in front of the second door and rapped quietly. The iron was so cold that it burned.
Clean clothes,
she said against the metal. It was absurd. In this place, with these people, they still insisted on clean clothes. 3 of the guards had paused to watch. She pretended not to notice, pretended to back away slowly. A scared little rabbit.
pretended to catch her mangled foot on something and slip. But it was real pain that roared through her leg as she went down, her chains snapping and tugging at her. The floor was as cold as the iron door. None of the guards made to help her up. She hissed, clutching her ankle, buying as much time as she could, her heart thundering, thundering, thundering. And then the door cracked open. Manon watched Alid vomit, again, and again. A black-beak sentinel had found her curled in a ball in a corner of a random hallway, shaking, a puddle of piss beneath her. Having heard that the servant was now Manon's property, the sentinel had dragged her up here. Asterin and Sorrel stood stone-faced behind Manon, as the girl puked into the bucket again, only bile and spittle this time, and at last raised her head. "Report," Manon said.
"I saw the chamber,"
Alid rasped. They all went still.
"Something opened the door to take the laundry, and I saw the chamber beyond."
With those keen eyes of hers, she'd likely seen too much. "Out with it," Manon said, leaning against the bedpost. Asterin and Sorrel lingered by the door, monitoring for eavesdroppers. Alid stayed on the floor, her leg twisted out to the side, but the eyes that met Manon sparked with a fiery temper that the girl rarely revealed.
"The thing that opened the door was a beautiful man, a man with golden hair and a collar around his neck. But he was not a man. There was nothing human in his eyes."
One of the princes. It had to be.
I'd pretended to fall so I could buy myself more time to see who opened the door. When he saw me on the ground, he smiled at me, and this darkness leaked out of him."
She lurched toward the bucket and leaned over it, but didn't vomit. After another moment, she said,
"I managed to look past him into the room behind."
She stared at Manon, then at Asterin and Sorrel.
"You said they were to be implanted."
"Yes," Manon said.
"Did you know how many times?"
"What?" Asterin breathed.
"Did you know?"
Alid said, her voice uneven with rage or fear.
"How many times they were each to be implanted with offspring before they were let go?"
Everything went quiet in Manon's head.
"Go on."
Alid's face was white as death, making her freckles look like dried, splattered blood.
"From what I saw, they've delivered at least one baby each, and are already about to give birth to another."
"That's impossible,"
Sorrel said.
"The witchlings?"
Asterin breathed. Alid really did vomit again this time. When she was done, Manon mastered herself enough to say, "Tell me about the witchlings."
"They are not witchlings. They are not babies,"
Alid spat, covering her face with her hands as if to rip out her eyes.
"They are creatures. They are demons. Their skin is like black diamond, and they have these snouts with teeth. Fangs. Already they have fangs, and not like yours."
She lowered her hands.
"They have teeth of black stone. There is nothing of you in them."
If Sorrel and Asterin were horrified, they showed nothing.
"What of the yellow legs?" Manon demanded.
"They have them chained to tables. Altars. And they were sobbing. They were begging the man to let them go, but they're so close to giving birth. And then I ran. I ran from there as fast as I could, and, oh gods, oh gods,"
Alid began weeping. Slowly, slowly, Manon turned to her second and third. Sorrel was pale, her eyes raging. But Asterin met Manon's gaze. Met it with a fury that Manon had never seen directed at her.
"You let them do this."
Manon's nails flicked out.
"These are my orders. This is our task."
"It is an abomination,"
Asterin shouted. Alid paused her weeping and backed away to the safety of the fireplace. Then there were tears. Tears in Asterin's eyes. Manon snarled.
"Has your heart softened?" The voice might as well have been her grandmother's. "Do you have no stomach for—"
"You let them do this!"
Asterin bellowed.
Sorrel got right into Astarin's face.
Stand down.
Astarin shoved Sorrel away so violently that Manon's second went crashing into the dresser. Before Sorrel could recover, Astarin was inches from Manon.
You gave him those witches.
You gave him witches! Manon lashed out, her hand wrapping around Astarin's throat. But Astarin gripped her arm, digging in her iron nails so hard that blood ran. For a moment, Manon's blood dripping on the floor was the only sound. Astarin's life should have been forfeited for drawing blood from the air. Light glinted off Sorrel's dagger as she approached, ready to tear it into Astarin's spine if Manon gave the order. Manon could have sworn Sorrel's hand wobbled slightly. Manon met Astarin's gold-flecked black eyes.
You do not question. You do not demand.
You are no longer third. Vesta will replace you. You—
A harsh, broken laugh.
You're not going to do anything about it, are you? You're not going to free them. You're not going to fight for them, for us. Because what would Grandmother say?
Why hasn't she answered your letters, Manon? How many have you sent now?
Astarin's iron nails dug in harder, shredding flesh. Manon embraced the pain. Tomorrow morning at breakfast you will receive your punishment, Manon hissed, and shoved her third away, sending Astarin staggering toward the door. Manon let her bloodied arm hang at her side. She'd need to bind it up soon. The blood, on her palm, on her fingers, felt so familiar.
If you try to free them, if you do anything stupid, Astarin Blackbeak, Manon went on, the next punishment you'll receive will be your own execution.
Astarin let out another joyless laugh.
You would not have disobeyed even if it had been Blackbeaks down there, would you?
Loyalty, obedience, brutality. That is what you are. Leave while you can still walk, Sorrel said softly.
Astarin whirled toward the second, and something like hurt flashed across her face.
Manon blinked, those feelings.
Astarin turned on her heel and left, slamming the door behind her. Elite had managed to clear her head by the time she offered to clean and bandage Manon's arm. What she'd seen today, both in this room and in that chamber below.
You let them do this!
She didn't blame Astarin for it, even if it had shocked her to see the witch lose control so completely. She had never seen any of them react with anything but cool amusement, indifference, or raging bloodlust. Manon hadn't said a word since she'd ordered Sorrel away, to follow Astarin and keep her from doing something profoundly stupid. As if saving those Yellowlegs witches might be foolish, as if that sort of mercy was reckless. Manon was staring at nothing as Elide finished applying the salve and reached for the bandages. The puncture wounds were deep, but not bad enough to warrant stitches.
Is your broken kingdom worth it?
Elide dared to ask. Those burnt gold eyes shifted toward the darkened window.
I do not expect a human to understand what it is like to be an immortal with no homeland, to be cursed with eternal exile.
Cold, distant words. Elide said, My kingdom was conquered by the King of Otterlin, and everyone I loved was executed. My father's lands and my title were stolen from me by my uncle, and my best chance of safety now lies in sailing to the other end of the world. I understand what it is like to wish. To hope.
It is not hope. It is survival.
Elide gently rolled a bandage around the witch's forearm.
It is hope for your homeland that guides you, that makes you obey.
And what of your future? For all your talk of hope, you seem resigned to fleeing. Why not return to your kingdom to fight? Perhaps the horror she'd witnessed today gave her the courage to say,
10 years ago, my parents were murdered. My father was executed on a butchering block in front of thousands. But my mother died defending Aelin Galathinius, the heir to the throne of Terrasen. She bought Aelin time to run. They followed Aelin's tracks to the frozen river, where they said she must have fallen in and drowned. But you see, Aelin had fire magic. She could have survived the cold,
And Aelin never really liked me or played with me because I was so shy, but I never believed them when they said she was dead. Every day since then, I've told myself that she got away, that she's still out there biding her time, growing up, growing strong, so that she might one day come to save Terrasen. And you are my enemy, because if she returns, she will fight you. But for 10 years, until I came here, I endured Vernon because of her, because of the hope that she got away, and my mother's sacrifice wasn't in vain. I thought that one day Aelin would come to save me, would remember I existed, and rescue me from that tower.
There it was, her great secret, which she had never dared tell anyone, even her nursemaid.
Even though she never came, even though I'm here now, I can't let go of that, and I think that is why you obey. Because you have been hoping every day of your miserable, hideous life that you'll get to go home.
Elide finished wrapping the bandage and stepped back. Manon was staring at her now. If this Aelin Galathinius were indeed alive, would you try to run to her? Fight with her?
I would fight with tooth and claw to get to her. But there are lines I would not cross, because I don't think I could face her if I couldn't face myself for what I'd done.
Manon said nothing. Elide stepped away, heading to the bathing room to wash her hands.
The wingleader said from behind her,
"Do you believe monsters are born or made?" From what she'd seen today, she would say some creatures were very much born evil. But what Manon was asking,
"I'm not the one who needs to answer that question," Elide said.
Chapter 41. The oil was sitting on the edge of the bathtub, gleaming like amber in the afternoon light. Naked, Aelin stood before it, unable to reach for the bottle. It was what Aerobin wanted, for her to think of him as she rubbed the oil into every inch of her skin, for her breasts, her thighs, her neck to smell like almond, his chosen scent. His scent, because he knew that a fey male had come to stay with her, and all signs pointed to their being close enough for scent to matter to Rowan. She closed her eyes, steeling herself.
"Aelin?"
Rowan said through the door.
"I'm fine,"
she said. "Only a few more hours, and then everything would change." She opened her eyes and reached for the oil. It took Rowan a jerk of his chin to get Adian to follow him to the roof. Aelin was still in her room dressing, but Rowan wasn't going far. He would hear any enemies on the street long before they had any chance to get into the apartment. Despite the Vogue prowling the city, Rifthold was one of the milder capitals he'd encountered, its people mostly prone to avoiding trouble. Perhaps from fear of being noticed by the monster who dwelled in that god-awful glass castle. But Rowan would keep his guard up all the same. Here, in Terrasen, or wherever else their paths might lead. Adian was now lounging in a small chair one of them had dragged up here at some point. Gavriel's son. A surprise and a shock every time he saw that face or caught a whiff of his scent. Rowan couldn't help but wonder if Aelin had sent the wordhounds hunting after Lorcan, not just to keep him from tracking her, and to pave the way for her to free magic, but also to keep him from getting close enough to Adian to detect his lineage. Adian crossed his legs with a lazy grace that probably served to hide his speed and strength from opponents. "She's going to kill him tonight, isn't she?
After the dinner, and whatever Aerobin plans to do with the Vogue commander, she's going to circle back and put him down."
Only a fool would think Adian's grin sprang from amusement.
"That's my girl. And if she decides to spare him?"
"It's her decision to make."
"Smart answer. What if she were to say we can take care of it?"
"Then I'd hope you'd join me for a hunt, Prince."
Another smart answer, and what he'd been waiting to hear.
Rowan said,
"And when the time comes?"
"You took the blood oath," Adian said, and there wasn't any hint of a challenge in his eyes. Only the truth, spoken warrior to warrior. "I get Aerobin's killing blow."
"Fair enough."
Primal wrath flickered in Adian's face,
It's not going to be quick, and it's not going to be clean. That man has many, many debts to pay before he meets his end.
By the time Aelin emerged, the males were talking in the kitchen, already dressed. On the street outside the apartment, the Volg commander was bound, blindfolded, and locked in the trunk of the carriage Nezrin had acquired. Aelin squared her shoulders, shaking loose the breath that had become a tight knot in her chest, and crossed the room, each step bringing her too quickly toward their inevitable departure. Adian, facing her in a fine tunic of deep green, was the first to notice. He let out a low whistle. "Well, if you didn't already scare the living shit out of me, you've certainly done it now." Rowan turned to her. He went completely and utterly still as he took in the dress. The black velvet hugged every curve and hollow before pooling at her feet, revealing each too shallow breath as Rowan's eyes grazed over her body. Down, then up. To the hair she'd swept back with golden batwing-shaped combs that rose above either side of her head like a primal headdress. To the face she'd kept mostly clean, save for a sweep of kohl along her upper eyelid, and the deep red lips she'd painstakingly colored. With the burning weight of Rowan's attention upon her, she turned to show them the back, the roaring golden dragon clawing up her body. She looked over her shoulder in time to see Rowan's eyes again slide south and linger. Slowly, his gaze lifted to hers, and she could have sworn that hunger, ravenous hunger, flickered there.
"Demons and dining," Adian said, clapping Rowan on the shoulder. "We should go."
Her cousin passed her by with a wink. When she turned back to Rowan, still breathless, only cool observation remained on his face.
"You said you wanted to see me in this dress," she said a bit hoarsely.
"I hadn't realized the effect would be so."
He shook his head. He took in her face, her hair, the combs.
"You look like
a queen?"
"The fire-breathing bitch queen those bastards claim you are."
She chuckled, waving a hand toward him. The form-fitting black jacket that showed off those powerful shoulders, the silver accents that matched his hair, the beauty and elegance of the clothes that made an enthralling contrast with the tattoo down the side of his face and neck.
"You don't look too bad yourself, Prince."
An understatement. He looked. She couldn't stop staring. That's how he looked.
"Apparently,"
he said, walking toward her and offering an arm.
"We both clean up well."
She gave him a sly grin as she took his elbow, the scent of almonds wrapping around her again.
"Don't forget your cloak. You'd feel rather guilty when all those poor mortal women combust at the sight of you."
"I'd say likewise. But I think you'd enjoy seeing men bursting into flames as you strutted by."
She winked at him, and his chuckle echoed through her bones and blood. Chapter 42. The front gates of the Assassin's Keep were open, the gravel drive and manicured lawn lit with shimmering glass lamps. The pale stone estate itself was bright, beautiful, and inviting. Aelin had told them what to expect on the carriage ride over, but even as they came to a stop at the foot of the steps, she looked at the two males crammed in with her and said, "Be on your guard, and keep your fat mouths shut, especially with the Volg commander. No matter what you hear or see, just keep your fat mouths shut. No psychotic territorial bullshit." Adian chuckled.
"Remind me to tell you tomorrow how charming you are."
But she wasn't in the mood to laugh. Nezrin jumped down from the driver's seat and opened the carriage door. Aelin stepped out, leaving her cloak behind, and didn't dare look to the house across the street, to the roof where Kaol and a few rebels were providing backup, in case things went very, very wrong. She was halfway up the marble steps when the carved oak doors swung open, flooding the threshold with golden light. It wasn't the butler standing there, smiling at her with two white teeth.
"Welcome home," Aerobin purred.
He beckoned them into the cavernous entry hall.
"And welcome to your friends."
Adian and Nezrin moved around the carriage to the trunk in the back.
Her cousin's nondescript sword was drawn as they opened the compartment and yanked out the chained, hooded